What's up, everyone? This is the Hillside Ventures podcast. I'm Shivan Patel here with a special guest, Keir Shah. And today we're going to be talking about his journey, particularly building a startup, what he's learned through doing that, his experiences in college, the impact that he's had throughout that and that he continues to have. So before we kind of dive in, let's have Keir introduce himself.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I've never done this before, so we'll see how it goes and take it by ear. But sure, a little bit about me. So I guess of interest to the Hillside Ventures podcast would be that I'm just now recently building a startup. And that's definitely not something that I thought I would do like when I was younger. So it's been a really interesting journey where almost many different puzzle pieces fit together over time that led me here to what I'm doing now. So career wise, when I was young, I was really into like math and science, probably a decent part due to like the encouragement of my dad, who always told me like, hey, you should learn to program, try this out. You know, build little robots with Legos, things like that. And some of it took and some of it didn't at the time. And some of it only took after the second or third time. So I remember like when I was pretty young, my dad kind of told me like, hey, you should learn to program. He didn't know how, but you know, like, oh, here's the thing. You could maybe use it, try to figure it out. I made no progress. At some point, I went back to it a few years later when he suggested again. And then it made a little bit more sense, but still not enough. And I still didn't really get into it. And then in middle school, when we had like a robotics team, and then there was some programming involved in that. And then we were building little Lego robots and I could see, you know, how the programs controlled this physical thing in the world. Suddenly it started to click. And then in high school, we had a real big robot programming team with like big metal robots playing sports. And that's when it really, really started to click. So kind of a stop and start journey in STEM, but I always knew that I liked math and science. And then once high school kind of ended and I didn't really know what to do. The thing that I did in high school was programming. So I thought, okay, I guess I'm computer science. So that's what I did throughout college. And where I met Shivan through is through the school consulting group. So I was just walking down the career fair in like the first week of school. And, you know, there was one club that really stood out because they were dressed sharply in suits and just had this amazing presence. Okay, I need to figure out what this is. And so one thing led to another and I joined the consulting group. And that became like a real dual passion of mine alongside all the computer science stuff that I got super involved into. And we can talk about that more if you want. So at the end of undergrad, I kind of had this like pretty strong proficiency in computer science, also had a lot of skills and great memories that came out of consulting. And actually, you might not know this, but I originally was applying to be a consultant at a big three firm. And I like pursued that pretty hard. And I got some interviews and I didn't succeed. So I was kind of licking my wounds and decided, okay, I guess I'll get a tech job. That's what you do with a CS degree. So I was lucky enough to end up at Amazon. And so I lived in Seattle for 2 years and I worked in, honestly, a team that I was very lucky to be put in, which was called Alexa AI. So we worked on the AI behind the voice assistant, Alexa. And it was a really great team, great environment, like great people. But it's pretty easy to coast and hide in a big company, I would say. And I kind of took advantage of that because I wasn't really bought into the mission and I wasn't so inspired. Again, we can get more into it, but I got very crafty and creative in the ways that I was not doing as much work as I probably should have. But at some point, I got fed up with that. I knew I wanted to really pursue something that was all-consuming and actually pushed me to my abilities. So I quit to get a master's degree at Cornell Tech, which is a one-year program in New York City that's all about entrepreneurship, basically, and like CS-focused, but with a real branding around entrepreneurs. That's where I met my two roommates who were also dead set on like, we can't do this big company thing. We have to build a startup. And for the last now 6 to 8 months, we've been working on different projects. And that finally led up to the startup that I'm working on now. And actually, I don't think you know this either, but we just got a pre-seed round. So we'll be moving to the Bay Area to continue that after graduation. But, sorry, long-winded story, but that's it.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And you hit on a bunch of different things that I would love to dive deeper into. I guess we can kind of start off after the fact of where you were in high school and then moving into your undergrad journey. So you mentioned UConn Consulting Group, shout out to them as well. You know, it's been a big impact on both of our times at UConn. So far, I still have 2 years left, so I'll be in the group closing out my career as well, but would love to hear more about what got you interested. I know you're talking about, oh, I see these people in suits. What is this about? Let me join. I want to be a part of that. Like as a kind of computer science background, like having that mindset and that perspective, what made you want to go into like the kind of the consulting route and that experience?
So I won't lie, at that time, probably a bit less now, but at that time, my motivations were really around like prestige and I want to be good at everything in school, kind of. Because like in high school, I think the younger and earlier you are in school, it's kind of easy to like be good at everything because everything's very similar. And as you grow up, things start to really become different. Like the different paths you can take in life really start to differ. And you see like different people get really good at one thing and not another, and you have to work together. But like when you're young growing up, it's not really like that. That's how I felt. So going into college, I was kind of like, okay, I want to just join every club that looks like the coolest club on campus and I don't know, become the president of them all or whatever. So that's why this club looked, it just seemed really cool. But I didn't really know anything about consulting. I'd never heard of consulting before. So I just told my dad like, hey, I got this flyer, you know, it seems cool. What do you think? And he really said, go for it. Consulting is one of those things where, you know, in 1-2 years of study, you learn this really broad generalist toolbox that you can apply to everything in life. It's just like a core skill set that will serve you well. So no matter what happens, I think this will be good for you. So, you know, I took that advice and joined and then just kind of fell in love.
Yeah, for sure. So as I understand, you did have experience leading the group and leading a project as well. So like, how did that impact your journey and kind of this open general toolkit, like building that and going forward and, you know, using that to your advantage?
Yeah. So in terms of the general toolkit, because that came first, the one thing I really like about how UCG operates is that you have to build on your competency step by step. So like step one, you come in, you're an analyst. That means you're given a task and now you have to do a really good logical structured job. Then step two is you're a workstream leader. So you start to set some of the tasks given like a really high level task. And when you're the project leader, you only have the goal of, hey, we need to help a company boost profits. And you have to even set the high level tasks and the low level tasks and help all the way down. So when I started, I didn't have any of those. So the first thing I had to learn was the, you know, really general structured ways of thinking, like thinking in frameworks. Okay, what are the components of profit, right? At the end of the day, companies exist to make profit. Well, you can make more money or you can spend less money. Now, how do you do each of these things and breaking it down? How can I, you know, a lot of times you want to group things into like maybe just 3 or 4 categories that explain everything. Okay, how do you know you didn't leave something out? Like, what are all the companies in the tech industry? I can just list Amazon, Google, Facebook, but I'm probably missing a bunch. So how can I group them into just a few groups that gets across all the different types, but where I'm not missing anything? So that's something that it's an intuition that you build with a lot of practice and it kind of carries over to everything. I mean, even at Amazon, Amazon is a very document-centric culture. So a lot of companies might use like slide decks or presentations. Amazon is really big on written text documents. And I got a lot of compliments on my doc writing ability directly because of what I did at UCG, there's no doubt. So that was like the first skill set, level one. Level two is now you're a bit in charge. And so that's where I started stepping into leadership. And I guess I had a bit of leadership posts, but not like never in really a high performing organization. And this was a big, big wake up for me because like anyone who's worked on a group project or something in school and you're like, whatever, assigned to be the submitter or the leader, like it's terrible when you're fighting against the motivations of other people to work as a unified team. And when you can tell that no one's really bought in, that's miserable, right? Like I would never want to do that. But leadership on a team that really is striving and really all has the same goal and like actually wants to win, suddenly that's way, way, way more fun. So just that experience was something really new, like actually being able to hold people to a high standard and knowing that they wanted to reach that standard and I can coach them to get there. And I can think of a few people like specifically in mind where that's exactly what they needed was like, you have potential that you don't realize. I'm going to hold you to a high standard now. And, you know, I was able to with help from advisors on how to do that. And then they came back maybe like after a summer and were just performing at a higher level. Like, and that was amazing. So, yeah, that experience was really incredible. And then as a project leader, now you get to deal with, it's not just leadership of people, but even the ambiguity and like pressure of, am I doing the right thing? That was probably the number one question once you reach the top level of leadership and then leading the whole group eventually, which I did, is like, am I even doing the right thing? There's a logical calculation. And then there's like an emotional management piece of it that says like, you know, I need to put my head on the pillow and fall asleep at night and like kind of trust myself with, am I doing the right things? So that was something that I got a lot of coaching on too from advisors and built a lot of self-confidence through. Yeah. So I guess I'd call that level one is the logical analysis. Level two is like leading people, organizing skill sets. And then level three is like managing your own emotions and regulating your own goals. And each of those is very general.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really cool way that you put it. And funny enough, I'm actually project leading next semester. So I kind of selfishly took some of that advice and to heart so that I can be ready and mentally and kind of prepare early on. But kind of with that, like again, then going to that next step and leading the group, kind of how was that as like another, even a bigger step up and kind of being like the leader of the entire organization of all the PLs of all the members and things of that nature.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I used to struggle with a lot, and I remember this kept me up so many times, but it was great learning. Because it's such a small group with really strong contributors, like there's this trade-off between a really, really small organization having to make a lot of concessions, like to for individuals, versus if you're leading maybe a group of 10,000, you can kind of set your policy and then let people fall in line to that, right? But when it's a group of 16, 20, 25 people like what we have, you can talk to every individual person, you can get to know every individual person, and it really makes a lot of sense to shape your policy around what like individuals desire, because there's not that many people, you know? Whereas with 10,000 people, you can't accommodate everyone, so at some point you have to make a stand one way or another. And that was interesting because I think like a lot of what I had heard about leadership growing up, or just the, you know, stupid image I had, was like, okay, you think of the thing, you set the thing, and then people follow it. And I'm not a big fan of that now. There's this concept of servant leadership, which I like the idea of a lot, which says you go to people and you lead in a way that serves their goals, because you're like leadership is a privilege that you're appointed to by the people you're leading. And that's kind of a mindset that I had to come into. So I remember a lot of cases where, you know, I thought one thing was the right way to, you know, let's say getting people to lead a project, right? We needed a certain number of slots to fill. The people who I really wanted to do it didn't want to do it. And then now I have to decide on the spot, like, do I make the concession and accommodate them, even if it breaks our entire 6, 8 years of tradition since the club started? It breaks what I think is the right way to do things. And yeah, and in a lot of cases, I had to give ground, which at the time felt bad, but now I look back on as compromise, because hey, it's a living, breathing, you know, organism made up of people. And that should evolve in response to, like, you know, the individual's needs.
Yeah, no, that kind of ties in perfectly to the next chapter of what you did with Amazon, because that they're catering to tens of thousands of people, and obviously they can't cater to everyone's needs. And as you mentioned, you weren't bought into you weren't as inspired, so to say, as you know the leaders who were kind of leading the direction. So kind of with that, it would be cool to kind of dive a little bit deeper into what you were doing with Amazon Alexa and kind of all that work and how UCG and your undergrad experience kind of propelled and like helped you land that position, and then how'd that help you grow?
So what we were doing specifically, real quick, it's really cool, honestly. Although now with all the advances with GPT, it might not sound that cool anymore, but at the time it really was. So basically, Alexa would read news articles written by news organizations like CNN, Reuters, or whatever, and then summarize them into a brand new news article that wasn't the exact text written by any one company. And so it was like a brand new news article written purely by Alexa, based on what Alexa had learned from news that other, like, you know, outlets had published, basically. So it was summarization of text. Now ChatGPT makes that look really easy, but at the time it was kind of cutting edge stuff. So that was very cool. I got to, like, at UConn, I always felt like I'm a scientist at heart, right? I have the mindset of a scientist above anything else. But I didn't really go deep into science or do anything that I thought was scientifically impressive or anything. And like, you know, UConn's a good research school, but I didn't feel like the opportunities were just everywhere. You kind of had to seek it out, and I didn't seek it out proactively enough. And that's something I regretted, because consulting is a bit of a different skill set, I would say, than science, although maybe in some places they're the same, but different kind of personalities. So getting to really see, like, what does the frontier of science look like? How do people operate? You know, what kind of people thrive, and how do they live their lives? And how can I start to live my life in a way to, you know, emulate these people that I look up to? That was really amazing. And seeing that it's realistic, you know, like it's not some special class of people that only can do science and are geniuses. Like, you too can do it if you just follow a process. That's not that crazy. So that was pretty cool. Yeah, I think the part that I didn't like, it's maybe like a youth thing, but like when you're young, you wanna take down the current systems and create your own systems, right? And so it's hard to feel connected to this million employee company that was founded 20 years ago, like by someone you've never met or never seen in person, even though you live in the headquarters. Yeah, I think that's a, it's tough to get behind that, that logo. So that's why I just didn't feel so connected to it. Like if I'm working, if I was to work hard, the rewards of that don't really come back to me. They come back to the company, my manager, my department, but not me individually. And I wasn't such a big fan.
Gotcha. And I'm just a little curious on what exactly you meant by crafty in what you were doing as for work there.
So maybe I read the book 4-Hour Workweek, which is a really famous book by a guy named Tim Ferriss. Yeah. And I got, this wasn't the whole time, by the way, this was just like one stretch of the, when I was there. But I got very inspired on like, okay, you know, how efficient can you really be with your tasks? How much time can you reduce and still be just as productive? Maybe I shouldn't get too much into it, but I, at one point I tried to, that was an explicit goal of mine, in how many hours can I do the same work? And let me see if I can keep beating that every day, every week. And for a few months, I found some pretty, you know, pretty effective ways. I didn't like it. I don't think I would ever want to work at a company where I felt the need to do that again, to be honest, because it just, it's a soul sucking way of living life. But one of the things that they tell you in startups is, it's, you should learn the basics of how to do everything so that you can hire for it in the future. So I think this is good in the sense that now I know all these tricks, so I know what to look for if I'm hiring. And if someone's, you know, like gaming our own company, I think I could spot the signs because I kind of invented them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I understand why you can't really go into depth, but it is super fascinating that this was something you actually did. And like you read the book and you did something about it. Honestly, like most people would just read books like that and just kind of be like, hey, that was cool. I'm not going to do anything, but you know, it was a good read. But kind of with that, like your experience at Amazon and kind of building out the software and stuff for Alexa, I think that's amazing. And how far Alexa has come, and with like the advent of like GPT and all of that sort of AI realm. You did have a talk with the consulting group and about like ChatGPT and like having a presentation on that and kind of like talking about the AI space, how really that works. Like, is there any kind of new research or anything that you've kind of been diving into there in that space and learning more about?
You know, it's not something I've actually followed that closely, even though my startup is using like GPT in production, but it's one of the really cool things. Like one of the reasons that GPT in particular has taken off, it's definitely better than other models, but there were a lot of really cool things that old models could do that like you don't know about. And I probably don't know about either. And like people just wouldn't know about. And that's because GPT made it really, really accessible and easy to use. So as a developer, it's like two lines of code. And it was not this easy in the past. So to use the most powerful state of the art model, basically, like it was a lot more work. That's a big innovation. And so because of that, you kind of don't need to know all the details. Like you just use these two lines of code that are given to you by the company. You pay a little bit, but not much if you're not using a lot of traffic. And you don't need to worry about what they're doing in the back end, because the model, as you've seen, is very general purpose and seems to work on everything. So because of that, a lot of developers and hobbyists don't actually need to follow the science too closely the way they did for the last decade if they were doing AI, because these models are starting to generalize and be good at everything. So you don't need one special purpose model to summarize text, one to, you know, write new articles, one to, translate things from one language to another. It's all done by one big model that's just super smart. An interesting thing that's happening right now in the field of science research, there's a lot of people who were like experts and researchers in this field who are having, like if you read on Reddit and stuff, you'll see a lot of this, who are having a lot of self-reckonings with their place in the world, because suddenly one big company built a model that can do everything. So you can imagine if you're the guy working on machine translation and now GPT does translation, summarization, everything, like what can you do? And now you think about it, that is the biggest, you know, as far as we know, the biggest model in the world, and it's the best. So you think, okay, as someone with a small budget in a small company, really, what can I do, right? It used to be that your creativity and innovation could produce some interesting insights, even with like not a lot of computing power or not a lot of computers. But a lot of people are starting to think that generation might be over. So it's the whole field of science research and the advances right now are, it's like moving so fast that it's demoralizing a lot of people. And I think there's a lot of people like me that are not following it because it seems almost futile to follow it unless you directly have a need to.
Gotcha. No, that's a really interesting point, and that like brings up the petition that was signed to kind of halt further, you know, progression of artificial intelligence for like 6 months, which super interesting stuff. Like, there are some serious consequences and things to think about if you continue to build something to this scale, to this power moving forward, because it affects, you know, everyone's lives. Like, technology is everywhere, so having something like this, like being able to do everything, kind of the being the Amazon of anything and everything in Google. So like, I don't really know how to explain that, but it's,
I'm curious, do you have an opinion on this 6 month ban? Like, what's your take?
I think they should take a step back and reflect a little bit more on like things that could happen, but also at the same time, it's interesting to see where this could head, because too much overthinking is never good, but also diving right in without any thinking is never good at all, because you never know what the consequence, because this is affecting everyone's lives. So you need to keep that into account and think about the implications it has on jobs, on, you know, people feeding their families at the end of the day. Like, if they can't make money, then well, what's the point of advancing artificial intelligence, you know? But don't want to get too deep into like that side of things, but it would be great to kind of segue a little bit into where you are now at Cornell and what you're doing there. How is that kind of helping you with your startup, and how has like your past experiences kind of got you to Cornell? Because that's an amazing place to be, and I'm sure you're learning a ton and meeting a ton of cool people.
Yeah, sure. So when I applied to this program at Cornell, it was exactly at the 2 year anniversary of Amazon that I left, my 2 year anniversary, not the company's. And I kind of made a contrarian bet that some of the people in my life basically thought was okay, but maybe not the smartest thing to do. So I felt at the time that, like, when I look back in my own personal history and when I've been successful, when I've been proud of myself and what I feel living a good life, the number one most important thing is having a small community of close friends who are basically working on the thing that I think I need to be working on, because that's the most motivating. So this would be like, if you really want to get in the gym more, like find a gym buddy, right? If you really want to, I don't know, focus on school more, find like a study group. That's for me been the most effective principle for pretty much everything. Maybe I'm very socially motivated, probably am, but yeah. So that was like pretty clear to me when I thought about it. So that was kind of my main goal. Like at the time, yeah, going to the best CS department, pretty important, or, you know, prestige or whatever, job opportunities. But I just asked myself, like, what is the best community I can be part of that will get me away from what I'm doing at Amazon, which is not so fulfilling. And the reason Cornell Tech, which is the small couple hundred person campus of Cornell in New York City, it's very new. It's very like experimental, been around for around 10 years, and really heavily branded around entrepreneurship. I felt like at least the community will be good, because anyone who self-selects into this pool is like self-selecting into a school that's branded around entrepreneurship. So like, at least I'm going to meet some kids that are into startups. And I have no idea. I didn't know at that time the first thing about, you know, maybe a little bit of entrepreneurship theory, but most of what you study in consulting is much more about big companies, and it doesn't carry over so naturally. And there's also like just I think it's a real advantage to have a baseline confidence of yourself as a business person, that maybe you grew up with parents who started a business, maybe you were the type to do like a lemonade stand in middle school. That is a real psychological skill that some people have and some people don't, and that needs to be developed. So I felt like I just don't have that. I don't have that business instinct at all, but I want to develop it. And putting myself in a pool of people that are all into startups, like, I eventually have to figure this out, you know? So that was the thinking. I think that was the bet I made, and it's exactly paid off as forecasted. So I've been really happy with it. Like, the number one biggest thing, you know, the coursework, it's good. At times it's a bit annoying, but some professors are really good. Some ideas have been pretty amazing in class. But overall, just being in a community of people, like being with two roommates that were dead set on doing a startup, that's just what ended up having the biggest impact. And I think I'm not so different. I think like a lot of people probably are underrating the value of having a close friend group around the thing that they want to be doing more of. And very often, you know, like it sounds a bit strange to say, okay, you're paying tens of thousands of dollars and like a whole year of your life just for that. You know, like, oh, you're paying for education. But really, if you think about the ROI, you're probably getting much higher ROI on this four friends you made than on, you know, hundreds or thousands of hours of sitting in a lecture hall. And I think we ought to evaluate that, like, as such.
Yeah, for sure. And kind of with that, like, what kind of like the motivation behind pushing you into entrepreneurship, just kind of based on what you were saying, it really has to do with environment and whether or not you were put into it in the first place. You wanted to get into the space and you were like, I'm going to figure this out no matter what. So you put yourself into an environment where it could breed entrepreneurship and kind of build kind of that mindset around that thing, and it just helps you build it up. So I think that's a super important point that helps kind of get you into the ecosystem and around the right people to do the right things that you wanted to do. So I think, again, that's a super key point. So yeah, so going off of that, it would be great to dive a little bit deeper into your startup and the work that you're doing there. And, you know, after being in this environment of entrepreneurship with your roommates who were dead set on building a startup and being in the space, I guess we can just start off, like, you want to give a little pitch of what it is and what you guys are trying to do with it.
Absolutely. So our company is a very early stage company. It's called Roger right now. And basically what we're building is an AI concierge for seniors who struggle with technology. So you can imagine we all have grandparents or seniors in our lives who, you know, can't do things like, let's say, joining a Zoom call or ordering, you know, food or groceries online, maybe getting a ride to a doctor's appointment or sending photos, receiving photos from family, all these things, right? They use laptops or computers, like, or smartphones, sorry, that are really just hard to use because they weren't designed and these people didn't grow up with it, right? So what we're building is a really simple interface, something that they already know how to use, which is a phone call or text conversation or maybe email chain. And that they can use to interact with a AI assistant, basically, that will carry out these kind of tasks for them. So, for instance, they could, like, call our phone number, say, hey, I need to order groceries. Here's what I need, you know, oranges, spinach, whatever. And it would place an Instacart order for them that would come to them. Or I need a ride. Okay, it can order an Uber for them. I need to send a WhatsApp photo. Okay, like, open this app. It looks like this green thing, speech bubble. Okay, now scroll down till here, click here. So it guides them through these things that are too intimidating, and restores a feeling of independence to them. Because one of the things we've seen is, like, once you reach that age, you were dependent, then you became independent in your prime age, and now again you're dependent. And that's incredibly frustrating to have independence taken away from you. So feeling this feeling of independence is incredibly important life priority for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, for sure. And within the startup, kind of like the role that you play in building all of this out, like, kind of explaining a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it's, we're super early stage. So everyone's kind of wearing every hat at this point. Yeah. The cool thing is all three of us are CS students. So we can all code, we can all sell, we can all, you know, like, somewhat well, and we're figuring it all out all on the go. I probably have the most technical background because I worked at Alexa on voice, you know, conversational systems. So right now I've been the chief tech guy. But yeah, I think everyone's been doing a bit of everything, which has been great.
Gotcha. And with, I understand, we'll dive into, like, the pre-seed funding a little bit later, but kind of like the plans moving forward, like the kind of the vision moving forward as from, like, the difference of what it is right now, I think would be great to kind of touch on.
Yeah, sure. So I think the long term, what we're hoping is that this can be a single platform that totally gives independence and autonomy to seniors by letting them kind of call and complete, you know, any task that they're limited with technology today. So yeah, whether they need to get tech support with some device they're dealing with, place any order, you know, become the gateway through which they can do online shopping or Google searches or navigation, can be a single platform or point of contact that they go to for a lot of these tasks in their day. And then, you know, take revenue on different transactions or different actions that happen. So whether it's a monthly subscription or a commission or a transaction percent on, like, online shopping orders or food orders and things like that. That's what we're hoping long term. In terms of where we are right now, so very, very early stage, one of the biggest lessons that you learn in a lot of these startup teaching programs is that you shouldn't spend a lot of time building something. Like, you should only build the minimal thing you need to test the risk. And I'm sure this is something you guys talk about at Hillside, right? So we've really tried to only build specific things that were kind of to prove customer demand. So in the very beginning, we had actually like a few ideas in this problem space that we cycled on that weren't getting great demand. We made like a simplified phone home screen. So because there's a lot of icons and notifications. So we tried making a simplified phone home screen that you can just download that will make it easy to find things and use things. It didn't get such a high response of engagement. We built something like a phone call service for health games and activities to keep their minds and bodies active. That also wasn't so inspiring for different reasons. It's interesting. Like, it was a big focus for caregivers for their kids who think about their health first and foremost. But for the seniors themselves, they kind of don't care about their own health so much. So it was a bit of an incentive misalignment. And so the end user, who's the senior, wasn't so inspired to use it, even though their son or daughter might be really insistent that they use it. It's not the best recipe for a product. So we didn't like that either. So after a couple of attempts, we kind of ended on this big idea. And in terms of now what we've built today towards this single platform with many different services, we've built an AI tech support agent that can help with like common smartphone tasks, sending photos, you know, receiving videos, attaching things to emails. That was one thing which we've kind of demoed in senior centers. And then we've built a reminder system for one person who's using it at home to take pills, join like a Bible study Zoom. And we're working on getting her connected through a phone call to Zoom audio so she doesn't have to go on her computer and actually do it. And then online groceries would be next and so on.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And like the use cases for this are pretty limitless, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, like any function that you would have on your phone that like we normally use, you would be able to kind of program a way to help someone, you know, who doesn't really understand, who didn't really grow up in this technology centric environment already and be able to help them. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think we'd have to, we're still really iterating on the idea. And you can't do everything over a phone call. So for instance, right, if you're only communicating with the person over a phone call and don't have an app installed on their phone, which by the way, was a big point for us because setting up an app is a big barrier of friction. Not to say we won't do that in the future, but it's a lot easier for them to call a phone for the first time versus having to install an app. That itself might need someone's help. So it's a big barrier. So now if you're only talking to Roger over a phone call, it can't scan the screen. So giving step-by-step instructions for certain tasks, like based on what's on the screen, is a bit hard. So you can't do everything. But we interviewed a bunch of people, probably like 40, 50 plus seniors over a month. And common things tend to come up. They don't have that many different priorities in general. You know, like it's online shopping, communications, banking. It's a few common things. So we know that a few of the big use cases will cover a lot of people.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like, just speaking from personal experience, helping my own grandparents out with technology, it's like the same thing over and over again. It's like, how do I download this app? Like, how do I do this or that? Like searching stuff up on the internet and like shopping and stuff. So I totally get that. And, you know, it's good that you guys are able to find that out early and get, you know, talk with these customers and really hone in on the problem. I guess like one VC sided question is like, how are you continuously gaining feedback from the elderly, the kind of the customer base?
Sure. Yeah. So one tip that we've heard from, like, I'm sure you guys watch YC videos and stuff like that, is they say like do things that don't scale in the early stage. So we're right now really nurturing personal relationships with the first few users. The first thing we did to get user feedback was we would take our demo product, bring it to a local senior center that we had kind of a relationship going on with, and then just get them to announce, oh, here's three students from Cornell. Like, they built this thing. If you want to talk to them, go meet them in the corner. And we would take people into a side room and use it with them and study the interaction. That's when we learned some basic tips of, okay, what really doesn't work? What kind of works? Hey, at this, first of all, here's a problem that they're really motivated to seek us out for. So tech support was one where they're, you know, they're ravenous to like come try our solution, even if it doesn't work well. And then once I see what's a real problem, then, okay, does our solution kind of work? Does it work in some cases? Like, oh, is it limited by if they have an accent and it can't pick up what they're saying? You know, what's relevant? So we did that for a while. Once we started getting a bit of confidence that, okay, you know, there is some real problems here, like maybe we're onto something with a solution, we've started to now deploy the thing like at home in people's houses where they can really use it on their own versus like us coming in and giving it to them. We're doing that a bit slower and also more one-on-one in concert with their specific use cases. Because one thing is, people will use a lot of things for free, but will they really pay, right? We need to make sure the willingness to pay is real. So we've been really now screening for people who actually, we tell them a price, they're still interested. Like, so that's someone who is willing to commit. And we tell them, look, fee trial of, you know, 2 weeks, and then we'll start charging you for real. The people who opt into that have an intense problem. So now we're building out specific features for them. And then we just try to follow up with them as often as we can. So the person who's using reminder system, we text them like every couple of days. You know, he says, oh, okay, she took her vitamins today, but you know, she didn't take them for the last 2 days because she said, oh, like, you need to eat breakfast first. So if we tell her to eat the vitamins, but she didn't have her breakfast, she's just going to think, okay, I'll do that later. And then she has dementia, so she forgets, right? Okay, insight unlocked. First, we got to tell her breakfast. Then we got to check in on her and say, now take your vitamins. So that's kind of small things that don't scale early work. But what we are hoping and suspecting is that those things are pretty generalizable. So once you see this pattern with one person, okay, there's a lot of people that need to take morning vitamins after eating breakfast. So, yep. So we think that at some point it will be able to scale, but right now you need to unlock those insights.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. Like insight there, like any other interesting findings or kind of challenges or obstacles throughout building Roger and kind of being a founder, honestly.
So many. So business specific insights, I can give you a couple more that were really, really interesting. One is that incentive misalignment was a big one because we thought at the beginning, okay, we want to solve this problem of seniors struggling with technology. Let's interview them. Let's interview everyone around them also. And look, a lot of times they might not be the primary purchaser because if they're not so good with technology, it might be hard for them to pay for something online. They might not trust it. They might not be able to, right? So it makes a lot of sense to also involve their kids or caregivers in the process. Now, if you do that, you need to be careful that the kids' incentives and wishes don't creep into the seniors and, like, you know, pollute the problem you're trying to solve. So this health thing was a great example where the kids will often say health as their top priority because they just want to keep the parent alive, you know, and like reasonably healthy. But a lot of people, once you get pretty old, you kind of start to accept, you know, your health condition, and it's not fun to maintain that the way it is when you're young. So they're not so incentivized and motivated to work on it. And that's why, like, they might just not do a daily exercise that their kid's giving to them. They might not take a medicine. It's annoying. You know, this pill is big. So whatever. That was an interesting one. Let me think. So we've also seen that they really, and I'm sure this will happen to all of us as we age and kind of lose touch with technology, but after a while, you start to really lack the abstractions and concepts that technology is like built on. So if I give you a new phone, like maybe I give you a brand of phone that you've never used before, you might struggle for a bit, but you have some patterns and, you know, mental concepts in your mind where you can map this thing to, like, okay, you know, the home screen on an iPhone used to be a button. Now it's this white bar that you swipe up. That's a bit different. The first time you wouldn't figure it out. But once I show you, you can map this white bar to, like, oh, this does what the home button does. So now suddenly I get it. You know, they don't have these abstractions, a lot of them. So really they're really just memorizing steps sometimes because they don't have the underlying concepts, and those are hard to learn. And so what that means is now if you change anything, even a little bit slightly, it can completely destroy the whole understanding. Because if you're memorizing step by step and one step changes, your memorized pattern breaks. But if you kind of understand, you can adapt, you can deal with this with these slight changes. So a lot of people complain, for instance, about like an app updates and then, I don't know, the button flips from the left side of the screen to the right, or like they just change the text on the button or whatever. And like you would realize, okay, they changed the wording on the button, but it kind of means the same thing. So surely it does the same thing. But now for them, if it's a different button, like you're scared, right? You don't know. Yeah. So there were some pretty interesting unlocks around interaction when we put stuff in front of people.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then I guess from like the business side of things, as being like a technical founder, how has that been, like any reflections that you have thus far?
Yeah. One thing that's been on my mind lately is, you know, in Amazon, there's a, like with any big tech company, you level up in different, you know, tiers of roles. So I was an engineer one, then you become like an engineer level two, level three, senior engineer, and so on. Principal engineer, you're in charge of big things. I never really felt like I got out of the comfort of being a level one engineer, which is you're given a task. Maybe you kind of debate it back and forth a bit, but you're pretty much, it's a lot like an analyst in UCG. You're executing on the tasks you're given. And if you're good, maybe you'll see some flaws and kind of argue, debate the plan until it makes sense to you. but you're not leading with the goals so much. I think because of this 2 years I spent at Amazon and then taking time off, also doing some coding and schoolwork, and maybe just some time for the brain to decompress. Now, when I go back to coding, I kind of feel like I'm developing this level two skill set, which is really cool. So I can see the higher level patterns of like, not only, okay, to build this, I need to use this, but also, wow, look, doing it this way makes this trade-off, where in the future, if we have 1 million users, it's not going to scale very well. So it's not a good way to do it. Or like, okay, right now it's really cheap, but it's slow. And at some point, this will be limited by how fast it can run. So I need to preemptively make this trade-off where, you know, it's a bit more work now, but it'll scale really well. Or like, don't worry, because scaling isn't an issue. You don't need to do this. What if we need to change languages, internationalize beyond English? Like, don't make this premature lock-in now that will cut off all your choices in the future if you're going to build something, you know, intended for an international market. So that's the level two skill set of engineering that, yeah, I didn't feel totally comfortable with ever at Amazon, I think. But some time away, I really feel like I'm starting to see the patterns now. And I'm pretty proud of it.
No, that's cool that you're kind of like leveling up in your own way and through your own journey through entrepreneurship. It unlocks a whole different part of people, I guess. But with that, coming back to the big news that you had for us, which was landing pre-seed funding. And you mentioned you guys were moving to the Bay Area. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think today's the first day now where I can finally talk about it. Yeah. So we got funded by UC Berkeley, has an accelerator on campus called Skydeck. So they were, you know, we were lucky enough to be funded by them. And so we're going to be moving with, I think, 19 other startups to basically live on the UC Berkeley campus for 4 or 5 months, talk to a lot of customers, write a lot of code, like not go out a lot. And then in 4 or 5 months, pitch in this big demo day, and then we'll try to get a seed round, you know, if things are going good.
Yeah. So just kind of going off of the experiences that you guys have had right now, obviously this is part of Hillside Ventures. We're student run VC. Have you had any other interactions with venture capitalists, any funds looking for funding, or has it just solely been programs like accelerators, things to kind of get you guys the ball rolling, basically?
Yeah. So at this point, because we're so early stage, like we've only been focused on pre-seed opportunities. So Cornell itself, because it's a startup campus, sort of has our own like on-campus funding at the end of the coursework, because our spring capstone is kind of like go build a startup. And so then the top spring teams compete for funding that comes from campus and do something like a campus accelerator. So that was one pathway we had that we were pursuing until we got this. Then we applied to this Berkeley one, you know, we applied to Y Combinator and some other big name ones, got a few interviews, but ultimately this is the best one that we decided to go with. So, you know, thanks to Berkeley.
Yeah, solid. And like navigating, I guess like all three of you are CS, like how have you guys navigated kind of like this business side of things, like this heavy business funding area as like technical founders in a way?
Yeah, you know, one of the things they say, and I kind of think it's right, is that it's a lot easier for a coder to learn the business side than a business guy to learn the code. Not that it's not possible, and that's not always true. But I think it's good, like none of us were total nerds who are only capable of coding and like not capable of social interaction, I think. Maybe that's like part of the reason we like each other as a team. And we also have pretty complementary skill sets, I would say. So like one of the other people on the team is much better when it comes to product and design questions than me, for instance. I'm probably like a bigger presence in the room, so better on like sales or whatever than some of them. Those fit together pretty well. So individually, maybe like any one of us don't have the total non-technical package of what else we would need. But between us, I think we've been able to put it together. And a lot of these things, like, I think things like sales really come from conviction at the end of the day, because what you're doing in sales, well, startup sales is easier, I think, for two reasons. It's also harder for some reasons, but two reasons why it's easier. Number one, you built the product yourself and you have total control over it. So if you really are doing something you think is good and you're working hard, you should have high conviction, and that should flow forth when you talk to people, right? Like if you're one of these traveling vacuum cleaner salesmen or whatever, you know, sales job was like kids were supposed to do in the 70s or whatever to put hair on their chest, like you don't really believe in the product. So that's hard. Yeah. But this is different. So that's one thing. The other thing is that you're information gathering a lot in early stage. Like, you're not looking to close every sale. You actually want to put the product in front of people and then, like a scientist, study their reaction to see if it's good, because you yourself don't know if it's good and you're looking for product market fit. And that takes personally a lot of pressure off me, because like, if they don't like it, it's not really a, you didn't fail. Like, it just tells you that this was the wrong idea. Good. Good that I found out. Now let me change my idea to something that the market wants. I can imagine that in a later stage company, where, I mean, you should probably always stay flexible on product. But if for some reason, if you couldn't and you only had to sell, that'd be a lot more depressing, because now you've just straight up failed. But when you can control the product and the sales, it takes a lot of pressure off me personally.
Solid. Yeah. So kind of just wrapping things up, it'd be great if you can kind of just give a couple sentences or like some parting advice for the audience based on all the experiences that you've had, entrepreneurial advice, anything of the sort.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I guess step one, then, to be self-consistent, and I think it's true, is anything you think you want to develop yourself at, find a way to find a community. And that's like not easy. And I think that's harder than people, like, I think it's harder than we think it should be, because it kind of feels like, oh, okay, how hard can it be to make friends? And so, like, around some topic. And so if it is hard, you kind of give up and say, okay, it's like, it's not worth the effort, you know, to actually go out and meet a bunch of people until I find someone who I really connect with and actually want to sink a lot of hours into something I care about with. But it's actually not that easy, I think. And for the same reason, like, dating is not easy, right? Like, you have to meet a lot of people until you find someone that's good, like, for exactly what you're looking for. So I really think that effort is worth it. And you should be persistent about that, because once you find this small team and you're going after it together, you can develop so much faster than you can develop on your own, at least in my experience. So that's the first prerequisite, probably. And then the other thing is, I think it helps to get more serious than, like, there's a lot of people telling you to, in your early 20s, to like chill and do whatever. I think there's not as many people you don't care about are telling you to get serious, but like your close friends and colleagues don't hold you to a high standard so often and tell you to get more serious. And I feel like, okay, when your parents tell you need to be more serious, you need to do this, it's like easy to ignore it. You don't really care. But the opinions you really care about are people in your peer group, and not that many people probably are telling each other, you need to, like, I believe you can reach a higher standard. You need to be more serious about your goals. But I do think a lot of people could be more serious about their goals and would benefit. So there's all these ambitious questions that people, you know, that people like to use. How can you achieve your 10-year goal in 6 months? Like, in what ways are you a total hypocrite about the goals that you supposedly have? I think those are even questions I ask myself. And you realize you're frankly not even trying at a lot of your goals. And if you really, really got serious about it, you'd start moving. And I have to check myself on this even today.
Those are some great gems right there. And I'm going to take those and run with them too, because I need to, you know, take a step back and look at it for myself as well. As, you know, selfishly, like, you know, I will take this podcast episode, watch it a couple more times and really digest some of that valuable insight. Because at the end of the day, like, if you're not going to hold yourself accountable, you lean on the people closest to you. And if they're not, then no one is. So that's a great point that you mentioned. And yeah, just making sure that we're just holding ourselves to a higher standard, to our potential, is super important. So I just want to thank you again for coming on the podcast and sharing your insight, your expertise on the startup space, sharing what you're working on, talking about ChatGPT and kind of like the artificial intelligence space and your journey through undergrad, like kind of grassroots from back when you were younger as to why this all came about and then kind of to where you are now. So yeah, I appreciate it again, Kair. But audience, if you guys have any questions or ideas about the podcast, please feel free to reach out. I'm sure Kair will be more than happy to answer any questions you guys may have on things we discussed today. You can also stay updated with us through this podcast, our Substack newsletter, and our Twitter at Hillside Ventures. But with that, we appreciate your time and listening to the Hillside Ventures podcast. This was Shiva Mitzel here with Kair, and we hope you have a great rest of your day.